This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. President Trump is on a week-long European trip. First stop in Belgium for the NATO summit, then to Britain, and then on to Finland for talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. This trip underscores the many ways that the president has upended America's foreign policy. He criticized NATO allies and pressed for large spending increases. But at the end of the summit, Mr. Trump said America's ties to NATO are very strong, and he added that he won big concessions on defense spending.
The United States' commitment to NATO is very strong, remains very strong, but primarily because everyone, the spirit they have, the amount of money they're willing to spend, the additional money that they will be putting up, has been really, really amazing.
Soon after he said this, France's President Emmanuel Macron denied that the NATO allies agreed to spend more. This summit is just one of many moving parts on the international stage right now that are affected by Mr. Trump's foreign policy. His approach has been described by some as repeal without replace, tearing up an American-led world order in favor of an international free-for-all, preferring one-on-one deals to multinational agreements. There are U.S. trade conflicts with China and Europe and Canada and Mexico and international concern over Mr. Trump's meeting with Mr. Putin. So what does all of this mean for Europe, for China, for Russia, and for America's place as a leader on the world stage? Joining us to discuss it is Jonathan Tepperman, the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy and the author of The Fix, How Countries Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. Jonathan, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Joshua.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program Francis Burwell, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Francis, good to see you again. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
And Rudy DeLeon is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's the former deputy secretary at the Department of Defense, former undersecretary of the United States Air Force, and former staff director to the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. Rudy, welcome.
Joshua, thanks for having me.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about America's relationships around the world, particularly the NATO relationship. If you have questions about the nature of NATO, the nature of any of these international relationships, we'd love to hear them. Or if you have experience working with NATO or our other international partners, share what you know about how those relationships work and what other Americans should understand about them. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Francis Burwell, let me start with you. Let's step back for a second and lay some groundwork about NATO. Plenty of people have been asking why this even matters, why this old treaty organization still exists. Nixon tweeted, "The USSR is no more. Why do we still have NATO? So 30 Western nations can take turns dropping bombs on Libya? It's ridiculous that we even consider still having NATO." So why do we have NATO?
Well, NATO was one of the bulwarks of defense during the Cold War, but I think it also has been an amazingly successful organization in the post-Cold War period. We now have a situation where we, the United States and our European partners, face some very real strategic challenges. Russia is one. Terrorism is another. Unrest and instability in the Middle East is another one. And although we have not seen NATO launch battle groups of tanks across to Russia and defending the eastern frontier, we have seen a lot of coordination between the NATO allies. And people like to say that if you didn't have NATO, you would have to invent it because you exercise a lot together. The militaries work together a lot. So, for example, the one time when we did actually see NATO invoke Article 5, the Mutual Defense Clause, was in defense of the United States after 9/11.
This is the part of NATO that says if one NATO member is attacked, it's treated as an attack on everyone.
That's right. And our allies then followed us to Afghanistan, and they remain in Afghanistan today, helping us under a NATO mission to defeat the forces there that were responsible for 9/11.
Fran, isn't part of the heart of the thought process behind NATO from the beginning this idea that America and its European allies need to have a constant relationship to prevent all kinds of international conflicts? The U.S. was involved in World War I, left Europe, and then had to jump back in to fight World War II, and NATO was a way of saying, let's not disengage again lest there be another global threat.
Right. It was a way of saying that the U.S. is committed to the defense and security and prosperity of Europe, and that Europe was committed to our defense and security. So I think this it's very difficult when you're starting to think about a military operation to put everything together very quickly. NATO, because it is an institution, and because everybody practices together, and because they have constant conversations like we saw at this summit about what the levels of defense spending are, what they should be spent on, and things like that, it's much easier to then actually respond together
Before I work my way around the panel with regards to spending, and particularly, Fran, how is NATO funded?
Well, there are two different ways of looking at this. First off, there is the NATO budget, which is a very small budget, actually. And we pay about 22% of that. And that funds the headquarters building, the people who work there. There's some planes, some AWACS planes that NATO owns. And that's all set up. There's a certain percentage each country pays. We pay about 22%.
NATO's overall budget is like less than $2 billion a year.
Yeah, right.
So it's not a gigantic amount of money.
But what actually happens is if you have an operation, all the countries who are involved in that operation, all the allies involved, show up with their own militaries. They pay their own expenses. So that is why, in order to be ready for that, that the allies have pledged that they will spend 2% of their GDP on defense by 2024. That is the Wales Summit commitment.
So there's the money that nations pay into NATO, the collective organization,
a small
NATO.
Amount.
And then there's the money that nations agree to spend of their own money in their own sovereign budgets on defense.
So they can be ready to participate in a NATO operation.
Jonathan Tepperman, let me come to you with regards to the defense spending that each nation agrees to spend sovereignly. President Trump had urged European nations this week to raise that commitment from 2% of their GDP to 4% of their GDP. It's a big increase on a goal on which many nations are already falling short. Here is part of what President Trump said at the NATO summit yesterday.
Many countries owe us a tremendous amount of money from many years back where they're delinquent, as far as I'm concerned, because the United States has had to pay for them.
Jonathan, what do you think of this focus on contributions to European nations?
Well, several points.
Contributions by European nations. Sorry.
Sure. I mean, the first point is, as Francis pointed out, NATO is not like a golf club where all the members owe dues, and if they don't pay their dues, then they're delinquent. There are contributions that they make to the organization itself, but nobody is behind on that. The numbers that Trump is focusing on have to do with what countries are spending on their own defense. Now, this 4% number, which he seemed to pluck out of nowhere, is totally unrealistic in the sense that not even the United States currently spends 4% of its GDP on defense. The figure for the U.S. is about 3.5%. China only spends about 2.1%. The 2% target is a good idea, which is why all 29 NATO members agreed to it all the way back in 2014 under President Obama. But the strange thing about Trump's rage at the summit was that the organization has made enormous progress in recent years towards meeting that goal. When Trump took office, only four countries apart from the U.S. met the 2% guideline, but four more are on track to hit it this year. And about two-thirds, so about 20 out of 29 members, should get there by 2024.
Rudy De Leon, I'm interested in your take on the way that particularly NATO and the European allies have reacted to this. Donald Tusk, who's the president of the European Council, addressed President Trump directly on the issue a few days ago ahead of the NATO meetings.
President Trump, America does not have and will not have a better ally than Europe. Today, Europeans spend on defense many times more than Russia and as much as China.
That's Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council. Rudy, what's your reaction to what he says? He seems to somewhat agree with the president, as do a number of other world leaders, that Europe should be spending more on defense. They should be meeting this obligation.
Well, Joshua, it won't be a surprise that this is not the first time that there's been a debate between Washington and Brussels on the level of financial contributions to NATO. If we went back to the 80s, very contentious time, the last decade of the Cold War, we'd see vigorous debates in the Congress about NATO burden sharing, that NATO had to pay more, had to contribute more for the U.S. forces that were playing such a critical security role. After the 1991 Gulf War, there was an emerging debate in Washington about the capabilities gap that had come to be between U.S. high-tech computer network integrated systems versus the systems that the Europeans brought that were still a generation behind. So this has been an ongoing debate for a while. I think what makes the current debate so contentious, and there's Washington is just at the center of every contentious issue right now, but it is, is it the talking points that the White House issued Monday, very traditional, about the NATO-Russian meetings, about driving hard bargains and how the security concerns with the Russians are very significant, versus the tweets that just keep firing out. And so there is a long stream of longstanding American allies in line to come to Washington to talk to various officials about what is the U.S. policy. Is it the tweet, or is it the formal statement that the White House has made or the Secretary of State has made on these topics?
Yeah, the tone of the conversation is one of the things I'd like us to discuss when we continue. Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire emailed, "I can understand getting our allies to pay their fair share. I cannot, however, condone Trump's tactics. It seems he has no regard for anyone's issues beyond what's on his mind at the moment. Such overt bombast and rudeness only exposes the weakness of our allies to their position. Add to that his pandering to Russia, and I am uneasy." Well, worth noting that NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg did confirm that the member nations have committed to spending 2% of GDP, would not confirm the 4% target. We'll talk more about all of the confirmations around NATO and our allies in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the state of NATO and the state of U.S.-Europe relations with Jonathan Tepperman, Editor-in-Chief of Foreign Policy, Francis Burwell, Distinguished Fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Rudy DeLeon, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress and former Deputy Secretary at the Department of Defense. We'd love to hear from you, too, particularly if you are concerned about President Trump's foreign policy approach to our European allies, or if you agree with the president's approach. If you think this is long overdue and it's about time someone said the kinds of things that President Trump is saying now, or for that matter, if you just have questions about how all of these relationships work and what it might mean for our future, comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Francis Burwell, let me come back to you. President Trump had a fairly blistering critique of Germany yesterday. It's kind of one of these more granular conflicts within the larger issue of the way we deal with our allies. Let's play a piece of what the president said, and then I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they were getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO, and I don't think it should have happened. And I think we have to talk to Germany about it. On top of that, Germany is just paying a little bit over 1%, whereas the United States, in actual numbers, is paying 4.2% of a much larger GDP. So I think that's inappropriate also. You know, we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting everybody, and yet we're paying a lot of money to protect.
Part of what President Trump said yesterday. Now, Francis, when President Trump and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel met yesterday, they were all smiles. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if we can pick apart what the president said. There are a few things in that that we should dig into. First of all, this thing about Germany getting 60 to 70% of its energy from Russia and a new pipeline. He said, "You tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. I think it's a very bad thing for NATO." How much does NATO have to do with energy policy? Is there any place for the president's critique on that?
No, not very much. There has been, in NATO discussions, a discussion about energy security, making sure that NATO allies are not dependent on any one source. But the president has his figures wrong. And Germany gets about 30% of its gas, which is not its total energy mix, but 30% of its gas from Russia. So it's not really dependent upon Russia. And Russia actually sends a much higher percentage of its gas to Germany. You can make the flip argument if you want. I think sometimes one of the things that has often puzzled me about the president is that he seems to think that the energy economy is that Germany is a command economy where the government is making these decisions. But in fact, it's often energy companies, just as it is our energy companies that decide where to buy oil imports from Saudi Arabia or wherever. It's not a U.S. government decision so much.
He also...
Can I jump in here?
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Jonathan.
So I think the Germany comments were very interesting and are important to focus on because of what they reveal about the way the president works in general. The first is he loves to confound expectations, right? So everyone is beating up on the president for allegedly being too soft on Russia. Well, so he comes in and he attacks Germany, claiming that it's Germany that has the problem with Russia, not the United States, number one. Number two, energy and the Nord Stream pipeline gives him yet another cudgel to beat up on Merkel, who seems to be his number one enemy internationally. Nord Stream is actually a Russian effort, not a German effort. So attacking Nord Stream is no favor to Russia, which is sort of typical for the president. And the only reason that I could think of that he would be attacking Nord Stream now is because he hates Merkel even more than he likes Putin. And, you know, the other thing that it reveals is the way that the president sees all issues as being related. So he's completely unable or unwilling to separate defense from security, from energy, from diplomacy, to from trade, for example. And his core theme is that the United States is a sucker that's being taken advantage of by all these countries around the world, especially its European allies. And he will look for any way to attack Europeans on that basis. And so that's why Nord Stream and energy, which has nothing to do with NATO, came up in this conversation, because in Trump, everything is related and everything is tied together by the theme, the strand that supposedly everybody is taking advantage of it.
And just to be clear before I go back to Fran, Nord Stream is the pipeline? Explain exactly what Nord Stream is, John.
Right. So Nord Stream is a Russian proposed pipeline that the Russians have been trying to get built for numerous years. It's not their first pipeline into Europe. It would carry Russian gas. The problem from the Russians' perspective with the current setup is that their main pipeline passes through Ukraine, which gives Ukraine, the government of which, of course, is no friend of Putin's, enormous control over Russian gas supplies to Europe. And so the idea behind Nord Stream is to cut Ukraine out of the picture by going around it and going around Eastern European countries entirely and provide a new access route for Russian oil and gas directly into the heart of Central and Western Europe.
Gotcha. Fran, go ahead and finish your thought.
I just wanted to return to the president's comment about Germany being dominated by Russia, because I think it's worth noting that Chancellor Merkel has been the one in Europe who has really led the fight for sanctions against Russia related to Ukraine and Crimea, and has kept those, kept the European consensus on those very firmly. So I think it's very much worth noting her very strong views about President Putin and Russian aggression in Europe. I would also just say that bringing up the pipeline, I wonder also whether it is less about substance and more about leverage, and particularly as we head to a discussion between the U.S. and Germany on whether automobiles are a national security threat, and automobile imports to the United States are a national security threat and should be have tariffs put on them, which is something we will face at the end of the summer.
I do want to move on a little bit further in terms of beyond the NATO summit in just a minute. But Rudy, I wanted to ask you about the other part of what the president said in that comment. He said he referred to who's paying what for how much of their GDP for defense. He said the U.S. is paying 4.2%. I believe, Jonathan, you said we were paying 3.5%. But the larger point I want to get to is he says, we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting everybody, and yet we're paying a lot of money to protect. This idea that the U.S. is kind of the world's security guard, that we're the ones who spend all this money and all our time and all our treasure and the lives of our sons and daughters for these other countries, and they're not doing their fair share in response or for themselves. How should we be thinking through that part of this argument?
Well, we've been having elements of this debate for 30 years, and it is that the U.S. is the most military capable force in the world. The Cold War ended. We saw the rise of terrorism. We saw the resurgence of Russia. We saw China developing as a global competitor. One of the problems with the president in understanding is, what did he really mean here? Because we probably know he didn't spend a lot of time reading the briefing book in advance. But there is, I think, in the security domain, an intersection between security policy, which the United States pays more than its fair share, and sort of economic strategies of the European Union, of the individual member countries. And so we know that home countries vigorously protect their farmers. They vigorously protect their manufacturing industries. And so all of these things are coming. The fact that the U.S. provided a security umbrella for Europe, and it also provided the economic rise of Asia, is largely based on the fact that Americans provided security from the three countries that had dominant crises, Japan, China, and Korea. And so with the American presence the last 70 years, we saw the economic rise of all of those countries because they were freed from a security burden. What we're seeing now, after almost a century of stability, is some of the old strains of nationalism, of I'll try to go it alone, I want to be more competitive in this global enterprise. We're seeing those economics interceding with the security side. Just one last point on this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I think my other two friends on the panel have described that in great detail. One thing we know about the Russians is that while they do have a formidable military, they don't always have a staying power. Now, what do I mean? In Syria, their air force came in, they helped Assad, but it wasn't conclusive help, and then they had to leave and they come back in. The one thing that Putin needs more than anything else is what we in the West call hard currency. And hard currency comes in through energy exchanges. When Russia is flush with hard currency, they're more provocative. During the 2003 Iraq war period, oil spiked to $140 a barrel. Russia was a large oil producer. Now it's down, you know, between 70 and 85, rising a little bit. But that hard currency goes straight into the Kremlin coffers, and, you know, gives them abilities to do sort of more irascible things. Yeah, so all this is in the mix. But what we don't know, we can be pretty sure that there weren't a lot of briefing papers that were consumed coming to that position.
Yeah, it looks like oil's trading at about $69 or $70 a barrel right now. I should note, by the way, before we keep going, we did get a number of messages from several of you who agree with the president that Europe should be spending more on defense. Here is some of what you told us.
I see no reason why President Trump should not call out our NATO allies on their contributions to our common defense. The Cold War ended more than 30 years ago, and today Russia is obviously no great threat to world peace. At best, it is a nation of outlaws and terrorists. If NATO countries can afford universal health care, they can afford more dollars for our joint defense.
I'm a retired Air Force member stationed in Belgium. 1998 to 2002, where I retired. Came back to America, and I've yet to see the NATO country military base here in our country stimulating our economy.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Thanks also to Michael. Michael emailed, prior to Trump, the status quo had allowed Russia to invade Crimea, North Korea to develop nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them, and Assad to retake Syria. From my point of view, that is more than enough reason to shake up the status quo. Jonathan, I heard you wanted to jump in. Yeah, please do. Please do.
So, you know, it's absolutely true that European countries, as we've established, should be spending more, which is why American presidents have been raising the issue over and over again, and why it was President Obama who got this commitment to raise spending up to 2% back in 2014. But the irony of the President Trump's attacks on NATO today is that arguably the biggest beneficiary of NATO at the moment is not Europe, but is the United States. And I mean this in several senses. First, there's the burden sharing that we've alluded to already. So it means that when the United States undertakes certain military missions today, it doesn't have to go it alone. NATO cooperated and participated in airstrikes against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. NATO participated in airstrikes in Afghanistan. NATO troops have replaced U.S. troops in Bosnia and Kosovo. So these are all areas where the United States has been able to do less because NATO members have been doing more. But another point that often gets overlooked is that the U.S. gets enormous benefit from its military presence in Europe, which it uses as a global staging base. Italy, for example, is like a permanent aircraft carrier for American planes, which allow American planes access to all of the Mediterranean and North Africa from the soil of a U.S. ally. Most U.S. military hospitals abroad are based in Germany. So when soldiers get injured, U.S. soldiers get injured around the world, they're medevaced into Ramstein and other air bases in Germany. The U.S. Africa Command is currently based in Germany. And without Europe as a staging ground, as a place to base and launch missions from, the U.S. could never maintain its presence in the Middle East or in Afghanistan, these key strategic priorities for Washington today.
Jonathan, let me stick with you for a second in terms of what came out of the NATO summit. One of the things that did come out of the summit is that Canada will be leading the NATO stabilization in Iraq. What does that mean? Does that mean that Canada is taking on a role that the U.S. used to do? Is this a new role? Tell us about it.
Right. I mean, this is the great irony of what we've just seen, and it reminds me of that tired old joke. Apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how is the play?
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing in this case is that apart from the disaster, which was the president's comments, the play actually went really, really well in the sense that NATO managed to accomplish a great deal, and the joint communique that they issued at the end, which had 70-plus points, involved a number of major new initiatives. They invited Northern Macedonia to begin accession talks. They created two new command structures. They launched a new initiative to improve military mobility within Europe to help equipment and material get around the continent. They created a new NATO readiness initiative, which they're calling the 30-30. It will allow NATO to create a group of 30 land battalions, 30 aircraft carriers, and 30 warships, all of which should be able to launch within 30 days. But then also, as you stated, the Canadians stepped up and agreed to lead a new training mission in Iraq with 250 troops. There are numerous Americans there at the moment, but they're mostly focused on mopping up the remnants of ISIS in the country, when what Iraq really needs now is help rebuilding its army into a capable fighting force of the sort that it lacked in 2015 when ISIS was able to rampage through almost two-thirds of the country because the Iraqi military just largely dropped their guns and ran. So the Canadians are stepping forward now in a big way. 250 troops doesn't sound big in the grand scheme of things, but for a country the size of Canada, where military engagements abroad are a very, very controversial topic,
right?
It's a major commitment.
And Fran, the president also signed onto a joint statement that largely reaffirmed the existing NATO commitments, some of which were at odds with some of what he said.
Mm-hmm.
What are we to believe? Like, how are other nations reconciling this disconnect?
Well, I think this is the problem with the president's diplomacy. As you mentioned, he did sign up not only to the joint communique, but also to the Brussels Declaration on Security and Solidarity, some of which is actually very tough on Russia, just as he goes into his meeting with President Putin. So I think the way to look at this, perhaps, is to see the president come into NATO. He ratchets up the tension with the allies in advance in order to give himself some bargaining leverage, or at least that's the way he perceives it. I think there is a real question about whether this is the way one negotiates with allies. And then as he leads, he must, in order to have a good meeting with Putin, he must have a strong alliance behind him. And so at the last press conference, after creating a crisis reportedly in the Ukraine-Georgia meeting this morning, he then says everything is great, and he got what he wanted. And then he's ready to meet President Putin on Monday, I think it is.
I want to talk a little bit more about what happens going forward with that meeting with President Putin, with his trip to Britain, where he's heading now, continuing to think through America's international relationships with Rudy DeLeon, Francis Burwell, Jonathan Tepperman, and more of your questions and thoughts. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Jonathan Tepperman of Foreign Policy, Francis Burwell of the Atlantic Council, and Rudy De Leon, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Still some time to get in your questions and thoughts about America's international relationships with NATO or with any of our multinational partners. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Fran, as all of this has been going on, the president has followed through with his rhetoric on trade, imposing steel import tariffs on Canada, the EU, and Mexico, attributing them to national security. We know there is an increasing number of tariffs against China. In the scheme of all of this, what kind of an impact does that have on our international relationships?
A huge impact, and a particularly an impact on our close allies, not only the Europeans, but the Canadians, and I would put the Mexicans in that category as well. And I think it's, look, the U.S. and Europe have a $5.5 trillion relationship every year. They are major trading and huge investment partners for us. And we do have trade conflicts. That's totally normal. Usually it takes up about 2% of that value at most. We'll be involved in various disputes about whether you can call champagne and all sorts of stuff.
Does it come from the right region of France?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Little nitty-gritty stuff like that. Europe is perfectly able, willing to countenance trade differences with us, but to ascribe them to national security when these are our allies, I think has been shocking to them.
Why? What does that actually mean when you say we're doing this for national security reasons? Is that like saying our life is in danger?
It means that if you're importing steel from Europe, that threatens your national security, or from Canada, rather than manufacturing it here. And the reality is that a lot of steel that we import from Germany, for example, equivalent steel is not made here. So the companies here have been struggling to replace it or to get exemptions for that. But the government perspective in Europe is, and I think the public perspective is, we're your allies. We're not going to withhold steel in a national security crisis from you. So why are you putting tariffs on this?
You know, it's interesting, Rudy, that the national security aspect seems to be viewed somewhat differently between the administration at the top and the Pentagon. I mean, there are Pentagon strategy papers that talk about the importance of NATO. Mm-hmm. There's also been some resolutions out of the Senate and the House in the last 24 hours that passed almost unanimously, urging the president to reaffirm the importance of NATO. But talk about just that disconnect, Rudy, between the Pentagon and the White House about NATO.
So if we look at the first bullet in the White House official talking points issued Monday, it says, our allies and partners magnify our power and protect our shared interests. Pretty much that's been the standard proposition going forward. I think that's the state position. That's the DOD position. That's the position in the president's national security strategy. I think, though, more and more, and your two callers who called in, first let me thank them for their service to the country. And then let me acknowledge that, yes, indeed, we do need our allies to pay their fair share and develop their own unique military capabilities. But we're now at an inflection point after 70 years with NATO being a very successful security organization. Some of the relationships are changing. In the immediate years after the end of World War II, we preferred that Germany and Japan make automobiles rather than tanks naval ships, naval vessels, warships. And so they've become very vibrant economies. We've now seen the economic rise of China as a global competitor. And with Xi Jinping as president, it's going to be a global, China's rise is going to be as a global superpower status managed by the Communist Party of China. And so all these things are in the mix. So this intersection between military capabilities, quite traditional coming out of state and DOD, versus economic competitiveness, I think that's one of the key issues going forward. American workers can compete anywhere, but it's making sure that there's a level playing field. And we know from trade talks that the Doha Round, ended in collapse over agricultural subsidies, not over high tech, not over automobiles or steel, but it ended up drawing to a long close without any accomplishment over agricultural subsidies in Europe, in South America, and in the West as well. So this intersection between security and trade, I think, is going to be a bigger and bigger challenge.
I wonder if we zoom out a little bit. We may touch on NATO a little bit more, but there's a larger question in terms of the way the U.S. relates to the rest of the world through the lens of the Trump administration's policy. It's this idea of America first, which the president mentioned again back in January. Here's part of what he said at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first, just like the leaders of other countries should put their country first also. But America first does not mean America alone. When the United States grows, so does the world. American prosperity has created countless jobs all around the globe, and the drive for excellence, creativity, and innovation in the U.S. has led to important discoveries that help people everywhere live more prosperous and far healthier lives.
Part of the president's remarks at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. So, Jonathan, what I'm hearing the president say when he says, when the United States grows, so does the world, this feels like a shift. It's almost ordinal. We grow, and then the world grows because we focused on ourselves first. You're better off, world, if we put America first. How much do you see that bearing out? I mean, does that end up creating more distance with America? Does the rest of the world get what the president's trying to say? Or does America first really end up meaning America alone?
Well, those comments, I have to say, were a little bit hard to interpret because they seem to conflict with other things that the president has said. In fact, they seem to gesture back to what has been U.S. policy and U.S. rhetoric for the last 70 years up until this presidency, which is that when the U.S. economy grows and other economies do as well, that we're living in a world where growth is mutually beneficial and is not zero sum. And yet, at many other points, especially in his more recent comments on trade, the president seems to act speak as though everything is zero sum. So U.S. can only grow if other countries grow less. The U.S. can only do well if other countries do poorly. The United States can only spend less if other countries spend more. But, you know, another related point that I think is important to emphasize here is that not only were those comments themselves somewhat confused and confusing, but it's important to remember that there is a big divide between what the president says or tweets and what the president does, what the president does and what the rest of his administration does, and between individuals and institutions. So we saw that at NATO this week where the president made very aggressive comments, but then this very strong joint communique, which had, by the way, had been worked out in advance, was issued, which seemed to be business as usual. And that was in large part because there's so much ongoing support for NATO and collective security within the rest of the American government, whether it's Congress or the military establishment. The same goes for trade, where the president strongly favors tariffs and sees things in as I said, these very zero-sum games. Terms, but not everybody in this administration agrees with it. Now, he's had his way on that policy in that we have now put these really sharp tariffs on a number of our close trading partners, as we've discussed earlier. But in the meantime, there are all of these important global institutions and regional institutions like NAFTA, which for all the debate still exists, right, and is still operating, and the WTO, which still exists and is still operating. Now, there are some sinister signs that the United States is actually trying to undermine some of these institutions. You know, we all know what's happening with NATO, but the United States is also doing things to try and weaken the WTO, for example, by refusing to nominate new judges to the WTO's arbitration panel, which means that in short order, there will be so many vacancies on that panel that the WTO will have no way of resolving disputes. And if that happens, then the president will have succeeded in undermining what has been this really important global institution. But for the time being, at least, it's still going strong, as is NATO, as is NAFTA, as is a whole long list of global and regional institutions.
So, Fran, are we looking at the emergence of what one could call, for lack of a better term, a new world order? I know that term gets thrown around all the time by, you know, sci-fi nerds like me, but this is different. And I wonder if the world is looking at this, the world outside the United States, is looking at this as a fundamental, structural, lasting shift, or as a hiccup. Are world leaders kind of hoping that, from their point of view, Americans make a different choice in 2020, and we can all look back and go, whew, okay, glad that's over. Let's get back to business as usual.
Right. I think the verdict is not clear. The clip that you played of the president and making America first and the rest of the world will grow as we grow, there's nothing really inherently wrong with that. The U.S. has been a preeminent, if not the preeminent, country in the global economy. We were among those and probably the leading country in constructing the rules of the current global economy, and we've done very, very well out of that. Most Americans have. Not all, but most Americans have done very well out of that. But now it is not clear the extent to which this administration, and particularly this president, are willing to continue to be the leader in the global economy and in the global system, if you will, the current world order. I think at NATO, what we have seen is a hiccup. The president came in, he ruffled a lot of feathers, but we ended up with pretty much the same declaration and the same conclusions that were expected. And I frankly don't think that this proposal by the president for 4% spending is going to go anywhere. So NATO, a hiccup. But in terms of trade and our economic relations with our allies, I think we're looking at a revolution. We will have to see what happens over the next few months because we're not yet feeling the impact of the tariffs that have been put on. And then we have one other, and that is, do we have another revolution on Monday with President Putin? I suspect it will be a mixed element. Maybe certainly there'll be something that the president can claim is a great deal.
The meeting between the two of them in Helsinki.
Yes, the meeting between President Putin and President Trump in Helsinki. Clearly there will be something that is a great deal for President Trump. We don't know what that is yet. There's some options, some of which are fit right into and follow from what we saw at NATO, and others that do not. So we have to see yet whether he is also going to upend our security relationships.
Before I put that same question to Rudy, I just want to clarify something you said, friend. Are you saying that you don't know whether the U.S. will continue to be the leader of the world economy or the leader of this form of the world's economy under its current establishment?
Personally, I believe that if you want to put up barriers around the American economy, you will diminish the American economy and therefore leave it more open to challenges by others and not to be the strongest economy in the world anymore. But it really is a matter of, do we want to be the one who helps set the rules, has a leadership role in setting the rules under which the global economy runs, or do we step back and let others do that?
Rudy, what do you think? Are we looking at the beginning of a new world order, or is this more of a hiccup, an aberration?
No, I think we're looking at a new era. I think the first big earthquake was 89, and it was the end of the Cold War. At that time, countries would say you had to be either aligned with Washington or aligned with Moscow, and the decision was pretty easy. That unleashed an era of globalization, terrorism, ethnic cleansing. Some of the old ways of doing things that were not very good resurfaced. But I think on the economics, globalization has picked some winners, it's picked some losers. And so what the next form of the economic competition will be, I think, is the leading challenge. And as you noted, Joshua, that's the next earthquake.
And Jonathan, what about you? Are we looking at the beginning of a new world order?
I would say another way to phrase the question is to ask whether the damage that's been done in the last year and a half or so is temporary or permanent, whether it can be undone. And you can argue both sides. On the temporary case, I would point to a couple of things. The first is that the United States had incredibly low standing at the end of the Bush administration. And within a few months following the election of Barack Obama, U.S. standing and popularity around the world had skyrocketed. So approval polls about the United States had risen by something like 40% in major countries around the world. Another important point to emphasize is that the United States still continues to provide all of these global goods like safe passage in global sea lanes, policing areas like the Straits of Malacca that nobody else does and nobody else is going to be in a position to do anytime soon because there's no good alternative to the United States as the world's policeman. On the other hand, there has been a lot of damage in the last few months that may be in some cases hard to unpick. I mean, the first is there is all this bad blood now between the United States and its allies. Mm-hmm. And what we need to start watching for now and the signs that will tell us whether we're seeing a temporary or a more permanent shift are severalfold. Number one, do U.S. allies start hedging their bets?
Briefly, Jonathan, we're low on time.
Okay. So do they start looking for other allies instead of the United States? Do we see more undoing of major accomplishments like the Iran deal? And the third is do we see other countries taking advantage of U.S. rhetoric by acting more aggressively on the assumption, for example, that the U.S. will no longer stand up for its allies, so Russia becomes more aggressive in Eastern Europe?
Jonathan Tepperman, Editor-in-Chief of Foreign Policy. Jonathan, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Francis Burwell, Distinguished Fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thanks, Francis.
Thanks.
And Rudy De Leon, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Rudy, thank you.
Joshua, thanks.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.